Welcome to Mindshifters Radio. Today is Thanksgiving Day, November 26th, 2020. This is a pre-recorded show. I would like to start out by reading something that I wrote, and it's I Am Thankful For. This has been a year of change and challenge like no other, especially with the pandemic. So first I want to say I am thankful that I was able to keep Dad safe and care for my granddaughter, and that we had enough of everything that we needed, and to have been protected and taken care of and supported when things seemed darkest, to feel the presence of love and to know that it is okay and that we can walk water in the midst of the storm. The following I have read almost every year, making a few edits each year for what has changed. It's a reminder for me, and I hope it touches you. I am thankful for, even though I often want other things that I don't have, I am most grateful for what I do have that I sometimes take for granted. I want to focus on the fact that I am thankful for Yahweh, God, and the love that He gave to the world, and for Yeshua, Jesus the Christ, for showing the way. I am able to freely worship in spirit and truth and honor my Creator. Thank you, God. And by the way, He is both my Savior and Lord, and there is a difference between those two. I was blessed with phenomenal parents who gave me life. Mom went on to heaven September 25th, 2017, so now I say I am thankful that I had her for as long as I did. I wished it had been longer, but she was ready to go. My dad is having challenges and is now no longer able to live alone, and I am thankful that I am able to be here for him as he was for me during my life growing up. I am thankful that he still remembers some things and that we can help him through the challenges. I have a son who is beyond words. He is the pride and joy of my life. He is the answer to my prayers and the very presence of God made manifest. I am thankful I was able to give birth and then to have been able to watch him grow into such a fine young man. I have a lovely daughter-in-law who cherishes me back and supports and cherishes my son. Together they have been wonderful friends, partners, and parents. Now I have been blessed with the most precious granddaughter, Aria Rainshaw. From the moment I laid eyes on her, when she was just minutes on this planet, I felt my being expand. I am thankful she is so perfect and healthy, and it's an added bonus that she is so beautiful and sweet and smart. I am blessed to keep her 2 or 3 days a week and to be part of her growing, learning, and experiencing the love that she is, and her reflecting that back to me as well. I have a partner who shares life with me. We have traveled together, do workshops and intensives together, and play together. He is presently supporting me so lovingly, even to the point of rearranging his work life to be here supporting me, my dad, and Aria Rain. Our romantic relationship is fulfilling, and he often takes my breath away, only to give it back and remind me to breathe. He has 2 great children and 2 beautiful granddaughters who I am privileged to share a portion of their lives with. His family has embraced me. I have 2 other amazing stepsons that have been in my life for 43 years, and they call me Mom, even though I never asked them to. That is acceptance. Their mom has embraced me as well, and we are good friends. I have 2 beautiful step-grandchildren through them, too. I was blessed with 3 fabulous brothers who call me sis. They have awesome wives and kids, some of who also now have kids. God has truly blessed this entire family. My eldest brother, only 14 months older than me, passed away July 24th, 2020. Giving us all a wake-up call as to how precious our time here is together. I have friends and loved ones who I know I can call on any time, and while we may not see each other that often, we remain close. I am thankful for that caring. I have a lot of people in my life that I consider friends, but more than the number of friends, I have a great number of them who are close enough to hear my heart and hold me in love even when I am in my stuff. They hear even when there are no words spoken. They see me. I am thankful for my health, which is good, and my body that serves me well more times than not. I am thankful that I am not too difficult to look at. I may not be wealthy, but I can pay my bills and live comfortably, although simply, And many people cannot say that. While I attempt to be perfect, yeah, right, I do make mistakes, and I am thankful for the gentle lessons given to me instead of the 2x4. The trials and challenges that give me the opportunity to forgive once more. I am thankful for my degree in psychology and that I was able to finish college a few years ago. I am thankful for what I learned as well as what I was able to share with my professors and fellow students. I am thankful for the potential that is now mine. I am thankful for good air and sunshine, even for the rain and the snow, and clean water to drink and wholesome food to eat. I am thankful for a bed to sleep in and a roof over my head, even though it is usually someone else's roof and bed. I am thankful for the ability to laugh, to feel safe and secure. I am thankful that I survived and learned from the times when things were not so safe and secure. I am thankful for the vehicles we have. None of them are new, but they serve the purpose very well. I am thankful for the time to see and do all that we see and do. Time to share, time to love, time to be. I am glad I have a cell phone and computer. Even though electronics present challenges, I am able to stay connected with those who I am away from more than I could without that technology. I'm thankful we have been able to use this technology to do workshops and intensives virtually when things shut down due to COVID. We had to stop the travel and close up Heartland, and yet we could move forward. I am thankful for experiencing love within myself and from family and friends. It is the source that we move through on this planet and what sustains us in times of challenge. The technology we have today allows us to see all over this great planet and experience things that once were not even imagined. This includes television, internet, radio, telephones, computers, but also the technology of cars and planes and trains. The opportunities we have today are immense, and I am thankful for them. I am glad I know how to read and write. These two skills have helped me move through my life more easily and have afforded me employment that otherwise I could not have gotten. I appreciate people I meet. Once strangers become new friends and support. Cherished ones become dearer each time we meet. Simple things in life. The crackle of a fire, a shooting star, the glow of the moon, the warmth of the sun, the smell of pine, the sound of laughter, the smile of a child, the beauty of the mountains and the valleys, rolled hay still sitting in the field, newborn calves gaining their footing, the sunset and the sunrise, the rainbow which reminds us of God's promise, for the sand on the ocean shore, the rolling waves, the salty breeze, for the falling snow that covers the trees and the ground, making all things beautiful and at peace. Family gatherings and get-togethers, reunions, holidays, camping, or simply shopping and chatting and eating. While we didn't get to do many of these things this year due to COVID, we stayed connected through FaceTime and calls and emails. Being able to express my thoughts and feelings freely, the liberty afforded to this country. I am thankful that there are those, including my dad and brothers, who have been willing to take a stand for this country and the people in it. I wish for a time when people awaken to do something different than war. I'm thankful for laughter and tears, to express without words. And more than that, I have so many people who hear the unspoken that comes from my heart and they genuinely care. I'm thankful I am above ground one more day, thankful for the morning and the night. Conveniences of running water and indoor toilets. Although I enjoyed being at Grandma and Granddad's when they didn't have these luxuries, I'm glad that I do. I am glad I can so easily obtain groceries and gas, that we have electric heat instead of having to build a fire. I am glad we have fireplaces for pleasure. I love air conditioning in my home and car. I love to flip a switch and the room is illuminated in light. I am grateful for the experiences at Grandma and Granddad's to learn how to milk cows, gather eggs, put up salted meat, churn butter, haul hay, grade tobacco, make molasses, harvest, and plant. Many of these skills will never be used again by me, but I'm glad that I learned them. I am thankful for my mind and that I can think and remember and figure and have discernment. I have both knowledge and wisdom. I am thankful I have all five senses. I can see, hear, feel, taste, and smell. I even have a sixth sense of intuition which alerts me when I'm paying attention to it. I'm thankful to hear a loved one's voice, to see their sweet face, to taste country cooking, to feel the touch of a hand or lips on mine, and to smell flowers in the spring. I'm thankful for travel and seeing so many parts of this planet. I'm thankful for home. I'm glad we have theaters, plays, bowling, skiing, hiking, biking, swimming, music, and so many other ways to entertain ourselves. And I'm thankful for the silent times when I can just sit, meditate, and just be. Thankful for my physician and dentist and pharmacy, and that they are willing to listen and do something other than medication. They are really healers, and I am thankful that there are modern means of doing surgery, etc., when necessary. I'm glad I have clothes to wear, shoes on my feet, a coat, gloves, boots in the winter, shorts and sandals in the summer. I'm glad my clothes are also stylish as well as functional. I'm thankful for my abilities, for the jobs that I have had and the experiences and growth, for the money I needed when I needed it, the ability to earn it instead of having to ask for a handout. Thankful for the diversity in our world, the cultures that give color to the universe, all cells within one body. I am thankful for those who have taught me along the way, my grandparents, parents, teachers, preachers, spouses, siblings, children, grandchildren, friends, acquaintances. Thankful for their time and energy. I am thankful I can dream. I am thankful for the innocence of children to remind me who I am. I am thankful, all of me. Jeannie.
Talk about the state where virtually everyone lives, and oftentimes without a clue that they live there. And the state is a state of becoming. Few realize that their structure is continuously following a set of instructions, and the instruction set determines what direction their becoming is going. You know, and the thing that kind of started this thought process for me, or brought this forward again, is we had Ari Rain a few days ago, and here's this little character who's just awesome, 8 months, going on 9 months. You know, the laughs, the smiles, the grins, the behaviors, the sweetness, the just amazing. But what was clicking as I was sitting watching her, you know, doing a new set of antics that she does, was thinking that just 9 months ago, less than 9 months ago, well, actually it would be 18 months now, talking about the time in the womb, but 18 months ago, there were two cells that weren't even joined. Physiologically, there's nothing that resembled Ari Rain in existence. And now, 18 months later, she's taking steps, she's babbling, she's saying things that resemble words, she grins. The phone rings, and it's her mother's ring, you know, calling when she's with us, and mom's at work, calling to do FaceTime with her. And she instantly turns her head. She's up in the living room, and she hears something on the steps, and she's craning her neck to see who's coming up the steps. Just 18 months ago, didn't exist. And if we were to show you a picture of her from 9 months ago, when she weighed, I forget exactly what, 7 pounds, you would see a physiological system that looked like it was complete in the moment. But in fact, 9 months later, you'd hardly recognize it was the same child. And what the conclusion that you come to, if you really think about it, is that this device called the body mind unit that is hers or yours or mine. In her case, two cells came together about 18 months ago, and a pattern was followed. A state of becoming happened. And when you realize that, when you realize it's two cells to this little walking, talking miracle, you've got to say to yourself, I wonder what she's going to become tomorrow. And then if you really question it, you've got to say to yourself, and what directs the process? What determines what she's going to become tomorrow? What determined what occurred from two cells to today? Something is directing, something is organizing that which started out as two cells and obviously have been plastic. You know, we talk about, you know, well, the two cells joined and they multiplied, like we have a clue what multiplication means. But really inquire of that. What does it really mean that those two cells multiplied and have become this new creature? If you read in Psalms, if you go back to some of the ancient wisdom, here's what Psalms says. Psalms 139:13 saying, oh yes, you shaped me first inside, then out. You formed me in my mother's womb. You know me inside and out. You know every bone in my body. You know exactly how I was made bit by bit, how I was sculpted from nothing into something. Like an open book, you watched me grow from conception to birth. All stages of my life were spread out before you. The days of my life all prepared before I'd even lived one day. And it says, let me rise in the morning and live always with love. So you realize that something is at work. And then you've got to ask yourself the question. If you have a set of twins, what causes in that state of becoming, what causes one twin to end up a drunk in the gutter and the other twin a healer that changes the lives of millions? What determines what takes place? And once again, if you go back to the ancient teachings, here in Isaiah 45:11, and here the creator's suggesting that if you want to know something, you ask. So ask me of things to come concerning my sons. So you have the ability to ask the question of a power that knows what it is that's going on. But then, you know, if you read Isaiah 45:11, it doesn't say, as it did in Psalms, it talks about the whole thing was structured before I even lived one day of my life. It's not what it says in Isaiah 45. What it says then, and what intervenes between the whole program was laid out before I even started, what intervened between that and what happens today? And what that second part of that statement in Isaiah 45:11 says is, concerning the works of my hands, command ye me. Here's the creator saying, all right, you know, we can almost imagine the conversation. We can almost imagine the creator whispering in your ear. Look, I formed every bone. I know everything about you. I know everything that you are structured and programmed to be. But now, You are my highest creation. I've given you this piece of plastic. It's obviously plastic. You know, if you went from two separate cells to the point where 20 years later you had 110 or 180 or 220-pound body, you obviously had a piece of plastic that's molded and being shaped by something. So we can hear, almost hear the Creator saying between Psalms and Isaiah, saying, all right, I knew the whole story. I know the whole story. And now you are my highest creation. I'm going to turn the whole game over to you. You tell me what you want. Of the works of my hands, command ye me, says Isaiah. Yeshua says it slightly differently. He says, ask and you receive. So what part do we play in our becoming? You know, there's not much that the Greeks did that I have a lot of respect for in terms of what they did to the scriptures. But there is one statement where the Greeks said, guard the portals of the mind. What are these portals? These portals are your senses. What the Greeks were saying there is, and I think in recognition of, the fact that your becoming is in your hands. Now, are there instruction sets there that might take you down some destructive, insane, bizarre alley? Yes. If that's in your genes, that instruction is there, and it's going to run itself out. Unless, understanding the process, you do the work that it takes to touch into those parts of your mind that hold instructions that would send you down an insane road, you uproot those instructions and you change the instruction set. Yeshua said it this way. You must forgive from your heart the wrongs of your brother. Now let's get clear that that Greek translation is so far out in left field that it's not funny. Unless you have the brain cells for what the Aramaic words say, it sounds like kind of a bleeding heart statement that you're supposed to forgive everybody else. But if we go back to the Aramaic, what those words translate as, you must take responsibility for what's going on inside of you. And if you're experiencing some form of hostility or fear, that when you construct a perception of your brother, you put into your brain's image of them, and then you say to your brother, you make me so mad, you hurt me so much, you traumatize me so badly. If you have the brain cells for what Yeshua is saying there, he's saying, whatever you're feeling that you put into your brain's image of your brother and pretending it has nothing to do with you, but you're feeling it, it's an energy inside of you, and you better be getting rid of it because it is directing your state of becoming. And if you don't ever allow yourself to tap into and deal with that, and I'd like to use an example. You know, we had a call from Peter yesterday from Sweden. I don't know how many remember, but about 2 weeks ago, and Jeannie, maybe we should see if we could find that show and juxtapose those two shows. Peter called yesterday where he had been processing some challenges and doing things like running, and he's been using the tools about 2 weeks ago. I think it's almost 2 weeks ago he called. And he was in despair, tears, hopelessness. The show ended prematurely. He just got in for the last few minutes, and he was in such trauma that I called him in Sweden, and we spent about an hour on the phone. And you've heard me talk about in the past the very, very few people that I've seen who've done the core piece of work of dealing with the moment when they gave up the awareness of themselves as love and bought into themselves as a set of messages that came from their power person, a set of messages that were based in pain. You've heard me speak about that, you know, over the last 8 years, probably a dozen times where I've said, and I only know of a few people, half a dozen at most, that have approached that piece of work. On the show 2 weeks ago, that day, that's the piece of work that Peter was doing. And he was in deep pain, trauma, and despair. And he courageously faced that piece of work, continued to do his work. And if you listened to him on the show yesterday, you haven't heard anybody higher than a kite than he was. And the results he's producing, having done his work, and the guidance and the flow of energy that's coming to him and through him into the world. We need people willing to do that to change the game on planet Earth. Yeshua said a little leavening leavens the whole loaf. He was not talking about bread. He was talking about critical mass and physics. Tap into the energy you heard in Peter's voice yesterday, the joy, the delight, the absolute. This is human life energy that he touched into and was sharing with us. If we could get a critical mass of people, I don't know what a critical mass would be exactly in a world of 7.5 billion people, but we don't have to get 7.5 billion people to do the work of forgiveness. We just need to get enough people who will do that piece of work, that will stand in the state Peter was in yesterday, join with other minds, and create that critical mass that delivers that the awareness of that possibility that we could be becoming according to the energy that Peter was talking about yesterday, rather than becoming according to the trauma that he was dealing with 2 weeks earlier. If 2 weeks earlier he cried his tears and, you know, kind of marinated in his trauma, his call yesterday would have been more of his marinating his trauma. In 2 weeks or 2 years or 10 years from now, he'd still be marinating in it if he didn't do anything about it. He would be becoming, according to that energy active in him, those frequencies active in him at that moment. How many allow yourself to marinate in the generational and the cultural energies of trauma? And how many say, I'm actually going to do my work. I'm actually going to allow myself to become aware of and access whatever's in my heart that's based in trauma that will direct this, literally I'm talking now, the cellular, emotional, mental state of my physiology. I'm going to change that energy into a link connected to love rather than just play out the generational traumas. Remember that story of the Jews wandering the desert for 40 years? And I go back to it often. Why? Because it's so instructive. They told us this group of, I don't even know how many people, went into about a 35 square mile area and was lost there for 40 years, four decades lost in a 30 square mile area. Kind of ludicrous when you realize that obviously these people knew at least how the sun rose and set. And at any moment that they'd chosen to, obviously, if they'd have been on the totally and completely wrong side of the desert and picked up and followed the sun, how many days would it have taken them to travel 35 miles and be out of the desert? This was not about being stuck in a hot, sandy place. What did they say had to happen to get out of the desert into the promised land? I would offer 2 weeks ago when Peter called, he was demonstrating to us what it looks like to be in the desert. And yesterday, he was talking from the promised land, the land of conscious co-creation. This is what that whole journey in the scriptures is about. It's not about theology. It's not about religion. It's about where we live. It's about who we really are. And it's about taking responsibility for everything that's unlike love that we could possibly feel and choose to forgive, to remove that energy from our structures so that it does not determine our becoming, that it does not mold this plastic, but rather recognize that there's a power in us. In Aramaic, Yeshua talked about Ruka Dekutcha. Ruka Dekutcha is a feminine elemental force in each of us that if we invite her into activity, will undo the effects of our errors and teach us the truth. Are we willing to be taught the truth? Are we willing to face, deal with, and remove everything that is unlike the state of conscious, active, present love in us? Everything that could possibly direct our becoming in a downward direction, are we willing to take hold of that, develop the skill and the ability to throw it out, and then recognize that that power in Aramaic, once again, Ruka Dekutcha, has a purpose and a plan, and the purpose in the plan is to build this world of so-called matter into a fit vehicle for the expression of who we are. In our genes, we've got this dog-eat-dog. Physiology came up out of an insane place. And then, into Adamos, came the breath of life, came nafsha, a spiritual being. And what the scriptures talk about, and it's kind of interesting, if you read those passages, you hear old Moses writing about the creation story twice, and I've heard people say, well, you know, he was getting a little senile, he didn't realize that he'd written about it twice. Go read those passages. He was not senile. He knew exactly what he was saying. If you listen, in the first story of creation, it talks about how in the image and likeness of the Creator, of love, he made them. Male and female, he made them. Notice in that creation saga, there's not a word about Adam, Adamos, which means red clay. There's not a word about the so-called body. And then you'll notice that the creation story starts over again. And he says, and there was no man to till the soil. Well, that's an interesting thought. Gee, we just talked about the creation of man. And now he's saying there's no man to till the soil. What does that mean? My offering is what he was saying is, there was no physiological component. We had not yet been incarnated into this world. We had been created as love in the image and likeness of love, period. That's a human being. Then it says, Adamos, the red clay, was created. And then you hear the story of the two being married. And I'm not talking about Adam and Eve. Is the two being married? It says, and the Creator breathed into Adamos, the red clay, nafsha, the breath of life, the being, the created being. And nafsha became a living soul, a living being. That is, one that was incarnated into a form. Love was now incarnate. Now, when you think about what's in our genes, you know, One of the things Gene and I have been doing late in the evening lately before we sleep is we've been watching some nature videos, some pretty powerful, I mean, beautiful stuff on YouTube. Just, you know, type in nature videos on your TV, on YouTube, and there's just some amazing, amazing pieces of work. And some of them are about the jungle and the dog-eat-dog world. You know, there are several videos about, you know, predators, and you see the pure power of that urge to eat and reproduce, and in many cases kill in the animal world. And you realize we're inheritors of that. So we have this abdominals, this red clay that has all of that in it. And there's a self that comes out of that that we refer to as the non-being self, the self based in hostility or fear. And you can imagine that self has been running the show. And you could just imagine the moment at which nausea is introduced to Adamos, the red clay, the non-being self. So being, you know, when we ask you to imagine, go back to the moment where you held a newborn child and then describe the essence of your newborn, and you describe your newborn as love, you're describing the created human being. You're describing nausea. And then there's all the structured programming of the non-being mind and the dog-eat-dog mind and the hostility and fear-based mind and the pain and trauma-based mind and the mind based in, you know, the fact that in the last 75 years we've killed over 175 million people on planet Earth in war. 175 million. How insane is that? That love could possibly do that. So imagine the introduction of nausea, created spiritual being love, and physiology, Adamos, the red clay. And Nafsha says to Adamos, hey, Adam, you know, I was just breathed in here, and I'm told that you have no choice. You just kind of run by automatic pilot, you know. If that lion in the jungle sees the movement in the trees and he's hungry, he's going and he's going to kill. And so that's just automatic programming. They call it instinct. It's going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it. But guess what? You who have no choice, Adamos, who have this pre-programmed instinct that are run by that and have no choices whatsoever, guess what? I have choice. So now I'm going to run the show. I'm going to run this body-mind unit. I have choice. And I'm going to have us do things that you've never thought of doing before. And imagine the non-being mind turning to Nafsha and saying, oh, really? You have choice, so you're going to run the show, are you? Okay, well, tell you what. I've been running this thing for millions of years. Let me give you a little test. Here's the test. You see over there, there's some berries on a bush there. They're kind of reddish. And you see right beside it, there's another berry bush, and those ones are kind of purplish. One of those sets of berries, if you eat it, it will nourish you. The other set, if you eat it, it will kill you. And Nafsha says, well, what do you mean eat? I don't know anything from this eating stuff. So the non-being mind, Adamos, explains eating and nourishment, and if you don't get enough food, you starve and you die. And Nafsha says, what are you talking about? Die. I don't know anything about that stuff. And once again, the non-being mind explains, well, you know, there's a point where we just fall over and we don't function anymore. We're gone. It's over. It's done. So Nafsha kind of steps back a little bit timidly and says, well, okay, I understand that death thing now, but I don't know which berries to eat. Maybe when it comes to eating berries, you should make the choice. And Adamo says, well, actually, I don't know how to make choices, but my instinct tells me, and I know which berries to eat and which ones not to. Okay, you got it. You take care of it. It's all yours. You do that. So you can kind of imagine them coming to this negotiated settlement. Adamos gives Nafsha another test. Well, you know, here we are out in the woods, and, you know, there's a Tyrannosaurus Rex out there, way down. See him down there? If he gets a whiff of us, he's going to charge up here and eat us. Do you know how to escape from him? And once again, Nafsha says, well, wait a minute. What do you mean he's going to eat us? And the non-being mind, Adamus explains, well, you know, he's going to put us on his dinner plate and eat us. We're food to him. Like those berries were food, like I explained. Well, we're food. Oh, we're in the food chain. I didn't understand that. So now, Mr. Smarty Pants with Choice, how are you going to escape if he gets a whip of us? And, you know, Noxious is like, I don't have a clue. I don't know how to survive in that stuff. Oh, so you mean you want me to run the show again when it comes to survival? Oh, yeah. When there's survival, you run the show. Okay, cool. It's all yours. And then when there's no survival, then I'll make choices. We'll run it through choice. How's that? Okay. So they come to that settlement. So now they have to determine what's a survival issue. And let's imagine that we develop an emotional meter that goes from 1 to 10. Level 1 means no big deal. Pardon me. Choice runs the show. No trauma, no drama, no threat. But as the emotional scale goes up and you get up around a 6 or a 7, all of a sudden this is survival. And we talk about the power person dynamic and the child subject to a power person, usually a child, though not always. It can happen in adulthood too. That one of the key components of that is the child perceives it as survival. So imagine that they agree that once the emotional meter hits 7, it's survival and the non-being mind takes over. The hostility and fear-based survival mind takes over. Otherwise, being love chooses the show. Now, let's imagine that you come to a why is this happening to me again workshop, maybe at your local university or church or library or wherever, university, whatever it is. And you hear Jeannie and Michael Rice up there talking about this state of being called love. I should hold a newborn child, and you tap into that and you go, yeah, the newborn is absolutely love. And then we point out, yes, and so that's who you are. And you know, you've got maybe somebody in your life you've been having some challenges with. And you go home and you talk to that person and say, you know, I learned something really important today. I learned that we are love, that you are love and I am love. And from now on, that's how I'm going to treat you. And you're at choice and you really, truly, seriously, 12,000% mean that. And then that person gives you the look. And what happens? Your emotional meter goes from 0 to 7 in a 25th of a second, and you're in survival. And you will turn with the most vicious mouth and the most vicious look and the deepest attack you can think of to protect yourself. And after you've taken a few breaths and you stop and you go, my God, what have I just done? Then you realize, and, you know, I mean, all that person did was turn their head the right way to give you the look. There was no threat. There was no survival. But your emotional meter didn't know that because that look triggered something from your past that was survival, that was based in pain, that was based in trauma. And the mind can't tell when a trauma is active, the difference between a real or an imagined experience. So now what is your work? I would offer that your work, Nafsha, is the work of dissolving all trauma-held memories within your structure, forgiving everything based in hostility or fear, so that no matter what happened, even if you were in a totally, completely life-threatening situation, There was no emotional trauma in you to force you out of choice into the automatic decision system and behaviors there. Now, when you realize that in your genes is every thought, every feeling, every reality from every generation in your bloodline, how often, as you watched your mother, your father, your sisters, your brothers, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins, your grandparents, maybe your great-grandparents if you knew them, how often can you remember them in survival? And what kinds of, you know, when you think of it, you know, here we are in America in a pretty safe place compared to the millions who've been murdered in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, by the invading hordes and the insane whims of kings. And you recognize that all of that was born and bred in you. And in a fraction of a second can have you going stark raving mad and tearing apart, metaphorically or perhaps literally, the person that you say means the most to you. What is your work? Clean up the mess. What is the tool? Forgiveness. What is forgiveness? Forgiveness is a simple, gentle tool with which you reach inside yourself and you remove everything based in hostility or fear so that you can come to the experience of yourself as the pure presence of active love, your created self, Nafsha, without reference to the past. And standing in that space, you stand in such a clear, powerful space of active love that love transmutes any threat that comes to you. That you come to the point where you trust that power of love that is in you. You know, there's an interesting quote in the scriptures that says, to you as human beings, says, if you trust in me, you can be in a battlefield where 1,000 or 10,000 will die and you can't be touched. This is the state that Yeshua was saying to be in if you want to follow the first law. If you want to be a human being, this is the state. He didn't say love your neighbor, love the creator as yourself. This is the state he said you had to be in order to function as a human being. Now we hear lots of people thinking, well, I love my neighbor. I went out and I collected some clothes and I fed them at the homeless shelter. So see, I love my neighbor. And yet, if their own child violates a goal they have for the child, they will turn with such a vicious voice and a vicious mind and a vicious hand to that child that it's unbelievable. And excuse me, that's not love for neighbor. That child is your neighbor. Are you capable of any form of hostility or fear? If you are, then you have work to do. Probably one of the most dramatic examples I could share with you, actually two that I'd like to share, but one in particular was very personal. The other one's not as personal. But I used to speak in, and still do on occasion, in Marietta, Georgia at the Unity Center there. And several years ago, I had a young woman who Sunday morning when I was going up to speak, said, can I talk to you for a minute? And I said, sure. Went and sat with her, and she shared that, or thanked me for saving her life. And I said, well, excuse me, I just got into town late last night. Whatever you're talking about, it wasn't me. She said, well, let me tell you what happened. She said, last year when you were here, I did the whole series of workshops, a whole week. And she said, since then, every once in a while, I'd hear your voice in my head saying the words, conscious, active, present love. And she'd say, whenever that occurred, she said, I'd actually kind of hear your voice. And, you know, it would like throw a switch in me and tap me into that. And she shared that about 6 months earlier, so this would have been 6 months after that workshop series, she had finished work and gone home and had just locked herself in her apartment and found herself locked in the apartment with a man who had a knife, held the knife to her throat, and told her that he was going to rape her and kill her, and proceeded to rape her. knife at his throat. And he said, Michael, I was absolutely terrified because I knew I was going to die. And then she said, all of a sudden, I heard your voice in my head, conscious, active, present love. And she said that, it's like that threw a switch in me. And all of a sudden, I was in that state of being. I was in that state of love. And she said, at that moment, all of my fear was gone. I had no concern. She said, you know, he's got a knife in my throat and he is actively raping me. And I have no concern whatsoever about dying. And she said, through that set of eyes, I looked at him. And I always remember her words. She said, all I could see was stark raving terror in his eyes. And though he's raping me and going to kill me, I fall into total, complete compassion for him. This is what it means to be the presence of love for your neighbor. This man is her neighbor. And I don't mean the guy that lives down the block. Neighbor in Aramaic means anybody that you think about. This is the state he was talking about. This is the untried state on planet Earth. She tapped into absolute compassion for him and looked at him through the eyes of Nafsha. No reference whatsoever to Adamus, to what was happening to her red clay, to her body that was being ravaged. The energy that took over in that situation was Nafsha, was that state of active present love. And she said, when I looked at him like that, he began to cry. He got up off of me and ran out of my apartment. That saved my life. This is the untried instruction of the man named Yeshua to all of those who would proclaim themselves Christian. To those who would proclaim themselves that, and yet under stress, turn to a mind based in hostility or fear and act out of hostility or fear toward the one they quote unquote love, supposedly. Don't tell me about your relationship with the Creator if when you're under stress, you turn to hostility or fear, because you don't have one. You might go to church every Sunday. You might sing all the hymns. You might tell all the stories. You might be able to quote every word of scripture that's there. You might have it all in that little noggin, all in your head, every word of it. And it doesn't mean anything unless you can follow that instruction. That's why he said, this is the first law. And he said then, upon this hangs the law and all of its prophets. In other words, if you don't get that piece together, you'll be one of those people that will help to create the 32,000 supposed different sects of so-called Christianity. And you know what? Not one of them is Christian. Because not one of them understands the prime directive of Yeshua. Be Nafsha, be the state of active present love. When you think of the Creator, when you think of neighbor, when you think of self, then you will understand what the scriptures mean. For upon this, he says, hangs the law and all its prophets. Until then, you're playing out a fantasy from the past, pretending to be something you're not. Do you turn to a mind based in love when the stress is up and the chips are down? If not, then Adamos, the red clay, the generational patterns are running your life. Your work, should you choose to do it, and this tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds, your work is to do whatever it takes to have the experience that Peter shared with us yesterday about being so deeply connected to conscious, active, present love. Now, you know, I don't know. Every phone call we ever hear from Peter, you know, one of the things he said is, well, he's coming from Sweden to the 9-day intensive. But he said, I'm just coming to play and have fun now because I got it. Well, I have a sneaking suspicion because I've had the taste of that too. But I haven't gotten to the point where I can live at 24/7, 365 yet. We'll probably hear from Peter, and there'll be some other layers that will come up, as with anyone. But do what it takes to have that experience, and then do what it takes to live that experience 24/7, 365. Then you will know the actual man named Yeshua and what he taught. That's what we're here to support. That's what we're here to arrive at. We're not here for a religious journey, nothing whatsoever to do with it. No dogmas, no doctrines. No, we're not going to believe this about blood and that about pieces of wood and hauling things. And none of that has anything to do with this journey that Yeshua inspires us to. You'll notice he doesn't say, I come to bring you dogma. I come to bring you doctrine. If you believe this, then you'll get to heaven. He says, I come to bring you life and bring it more abundantly. That is all. And your life is your nafsha. It is your state of being. And all you're getting, get being. Or you aren't. So that's what we're here to understand ourselves and understand when Adamos, with its past and its hostilities and fears, wants to take over, to understand so powerfully that we're actually able to do that work, not believe somebody's beliefs. You know, there's an interesting passage in the scriptures where bunch of the disciples come together with Yeshua, and they're like, well, how do we do this? How do we live like you do? And Yeshua gives them instruction, and half of them get up and say, too hard a saying, and they leave, and they never come back. That half made up a story. Well, there's nothing you can do, you just have to believe. And they ignored his instruction that there's work to be done. And they made up this whole story, and there are millions of people who believe this. Oh, yes, well, all I have to do is say these magic words and believe, and then, and they totally, completely ignore what the man said. They listen to what the followers who said too hard a saying said, and they leave the teaching behind. The book I'm working on starts out with Yeshua saying, you realize that first they killed my body, then they killed my teaching. I said, be the presence of love for those who hate you. Do good to those who despitefully use you. It's time for my words to be heeded, not for somebody's doctrine and dogma to be believed, because it ain't going to get you there. That's the journey he describes. It's not a journey for wimps. It's a major piece of work to be done. So the next time that hostility or fear-based dog-eat-dog mind raises its hackles, when the stress is up and the chips are down, who are you going to listen to? What's in your wallet? What's in your carbon-based memory? Is it the real thing? Or is it some fake doctrine that says, oh, I just have to believe and everything's going to be okay. I can rape, you know, my child. I can, you know, scream at my parent. I can rage at myself in the mirror. I can even go out and destroy myself. But I believe, so therefore everything's okay. No, there's a piece of work to be done, and it's a big piece of work. He's calling everyone to that piece of work, and it is not a wimp's work. It is a major project to be done. And the purpose of us being here with you is to share that understanding with you and to support you in the process and to bring forward each and every one of the tools to the best of our understanding and ability today. Hopefully tomorrow will be even the deeper understanding. you know, ultimately, we get to the point where we have the funding to be able to finish the translation of the first century Aramaic text called the Kabbalists. Maybe we'll find out more about what we don't know yet. But right now, we've got plenty to work with. And we invite you into that work. And we're honored and delighted that you're here to be a listening ear for it and pass it on.